This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from Master Wu Min's Gateless Gate, Case 8. Shichung makes carts, the main case. Master Weian said to a monastic, Shichung made a cart whose wheels had 100 spokes. Take both front and rear parts away and remove the axle. Then, what will it be? Woman's commentary. If you can immediately see through this, your eye will be like a shooting star and your spirituality like lightning. In the poem, when the vividly working wheel turns, even an expert is lost. Four directions, above and below, south, north, east, and west. So this weekend, we've been conducting an introductory retreat, which we're concluding with this talk. And I thought this would be a good way to speak about this fundamental basis of Buddhist practice, which is what we call the self. The Buddha taught that the Eightfold Path is a path of liberation, a liberation from suffering. That dukkha, dissatisfaction, disappointment, are ceaseless efforts to control and manage our inner and outer experiences, is born out of thirst and grasping and clinging, searching for that which will ultimately please us and that which will never cause us pain, and that there is a freedom from that. There is a cessation of that cycle, and that there is a path to realize that for oneself. But why this thirst? Why this clinging? Why do we see attachments on display everywhere? Within ourselves, outside of ourselves, within institutions and governments. And why, once we see the attachments, the cycle, we see the suffering, why isn't that enough? Why don't they just cease? We're reasonably intelligent, logical beings. Right? Why, when we see that there is a process we are engaged in which is causing suffering, why don't we just stop that process? Why don't we just free ourselves? The koan is a teaching within the Zen tradition. It's a practice within the Zen tradition, and part of its power is that it taps into, you might say, taps into the basic desire that we have as human beings to understand, to want to know. This world, ourselves, each other, life and death, to have something that we call meaning, to give what we call purpose to our lives. And so the koan is a very powerful way to reveal what has never been hidden, to express the inconceivable. In the writings of the Theragata, some of the writings we're using for the Ango, these are the writings of early female monastics of the Buddha. There's one in which Mittakali writes a poem. She says, I went forth in confidence from home to homelessness, to the monastic life. I wandered about looking for gain and recognition. I ignored the highest goal, taken to any low goal instead, ruled by defiling compulsions. I never knew what a true practitioner's goal was. This is from within her practice. She is still continuing those habits. Then while I was seated in my hut, I began to fear the inevitable. I knew I was on the wrong road, under the rule of craving, of thirst. Life is short. Old age and illness already crush me. There's no time to waste before this body is broken by old age. Looking at a person and seeing that a person is made only of impersonal parts, seeing those as they change over time, waxing and waning. I stood up, my mind freed, the Buddha's teaching done. The mind freed from what? I like that poem because she's expressing how from within her having left, supposedly, the world of entanglements, the world of attachments, she continued that world within her mind, which is that world, until she finally saw and experienced that that path, those paths that she had taken for so long were coming closer, crushing her. And so finally she actually turned towards the Dharma. You know, that's why there has to be so much repetition of the teachings, because we hear them and we hear them, but we're all pretty hard-headed, pretty stubborn. You know, we do what we have done before. We continue to know what we have known. And even when those things have not worked, do not work, we can still persist until there's a moment. The Buddha realized we can realize it from the beginning. All beings are in our very nature free, and not in an abstract sense, free of conflict, free of suffering, free of divisions, of confusion, of fear. Why don't we know this if that's our basic nature? Why, when we believe in it and have faith in it, is that not enough? Why, when we practice it in that moment of practice, is that not enough? Why don't we live this truth? And so Mittakali gives an example of how that happens, right? Just because we begin to recognize something, just because we may feel the desire and the resolve to turn, to walk that path, to free ourselves of those habits, that alone is not enough. That can be one of the most important moments or shifts in our entire life, raising bodhicitta, the way-seeking mind. But that itself, that's why Shantideva says there is adopting bodhicitta, there is recognizing these dissatisfactions, these ultimate unsuccessful paths that we have taken. But then there has to be attending to bodhicitta, practicing it, living it day by day. And so to have a searching heart and mind, raise the way-seeking desire, the thought of enlightenment, the aspiration, to practice exhausting these old paths. You know, that question comes up again. I see the habits. I keep doing them. Why do I keep doing them? The Buddha, in being asked that question by a lay practitioner, said, because you still believe in them. You practice them because you believe in them on some level. You may also believe that they're not no longer necessary, no longer true, no longer what you want to be doing, but at the same time, you do still believe in them, and so you do still follow them. And so that's why we have to, you know, right understanding of undermining that deep, deep belief, that faith, because it's not just a passive thing. It's not just a passive, it's a very active faith. It's an entrusting. And that takes time. And repeated experiences, repeated insights and realizations and experiences that they're not true, that they're not no longer viable. And but we can't, that also doesn't happen in a void. We also at the same time have to be showing ourselves that there is a path that is true. And so the desire to let go, to let cast off old ways and attachments and clinging. But clinging to what? And to whom? To whom are we bound? To what are we bound? And so Master Weian, this is a 11th and 12th century Chinese master, descended from Master Lin Qi, the Rinzai master, one day said, Shichung, who was a very famous cart maker in ancient China, who made a cart whose wheels had 100 spokes, so that must mean that that was a phenomenal achievement at that time. Awe-inspiring. He made this amazing, exquisite cart with 100 spokes. When you take both the front and rear parts away and remove the axle, now, what is it? And so here, this master uses this very simple story to talk about something very fundamental, but to direct our attention to it in a very particular way. It's not a philosophical question. He's not asking about how do you make a cart or how do you take it apart. And you might say, well, he's not really even talking about a cart. He must be talking about the self. True, but he is talking about a cart. That's also true. In the same way that we need to understand how do we construct what we call the self, in this person, we also need to see how do we construct the self, a sense of separateness, distinctness, which gives rise to the conflicts and divisions and competitiveness and confusion. We need to see that also in everything else, in everything. What is it now, he asks. And so most would see this, with a little bit of Buddhist understanding or training, would see this as a koan that is talking about shunyata, the emptiness of the self. That the self is nothing more than aggregates, a coming together, a concert of parts. Wheels, axles, frame, legs, arms, head, torso. And when you take them away, now what is it? Shibayama, in commenting on this, says, this is a Buddhist teaching, but this is not Zen. And so right at the beginning, he takes away any notion that a person may have of, oh, I know what this is about. The Dalai Lama, so Master Weian points to this very directly. Now what is it? Now who are you? And of course, we also have to ask, what is this taking apart? Right now, taken apart. It's not about dissection or amputation or deconstruction. Right now, it's taken apart. What is it now? What are you right now? If it's already taken apart, why does it seem so well constructed? I read a little bit last week from text by the Dalai Lama where he's making comments on the last section of the Shantideva's Guide to a Bodhisattva Way of Life on wisdom, the Prajnaparamita chapter. And this is hands down the most difficult chapter of the text. In fact, there are some teachers who have quite nice commentaries on all the other chapters and don't do this one. And so I want to read from some of this. And some of it's a little dense, so I'm going to just ask you to stay with me here and I'll try and flesh this out. But I wanted to bring this out for some particular reasons in terms of how the Dalai Lama speaks of this. So he says, while dreaming, all kinds of things may come to mind, but these are nothing more than appearances. So while dreaming, things come to mind, and this is a, you know, our language is, can confuse us and sort of point in wrong directions, but sometimes it says exactly our experience. So while dreaming, which includes right now, things seem to come to mind, right? They come to our minds. Thoughts just come. Emotions arise and we become aware of them. I open my eyes and you come to my mind. I hear a sound and it comes, right? It comes from somewhere and it comes to. This is how we experience things. They come to me. And so in that, you know, why does Buddhism dig so deeply into consciousness, mind, perception? What happens in these moments of contact? How do we know the world other than this? Are there other ways of knowing the world? And so things come to mind, and the Dalai Lama says they're nothing more than appearances, which is quite a statement. If we examine this, they're nothing more than appearances. He says, likewise, a magician can create a variety of illusory appearances, but they do not exist objectively, right? Sleight of hand. I remember watching this guy once, who's purportedly one of the best magicians in the world, and he was standing, there was a group of people standing in a circle, and they knew, I mean, it was all set up, right? And they knew that he was this really good magician and that he was going to, and part of his ability was to steal things from you. So everybody knew from the beginning, this guy is really good at stealing things from me. So when he gets close to me, he's going to be stealing things from me, right? So everybody knew up front what was going to happen. And so they're just standing there, and he just very simply just starts moving around, talking, having casual conversations. Everybody's aware of what's happening. And he comes, and at the end, he circles back around, and then he starts unloading his pockets. And he's got watches and wallets and, you know, things that were like, you know, deep down and, you know, and nobody saw it, right? Quite a skill. Now, if he put that skill to forgetting the self, stealing selves away from others. So here he says, he likens it to magic tricks, which is a very old example that's used in Buddhism. They do not exist objectively. Well, then how do they exist? They are nothing more than appearances. And this is very, you know, this is the very heart of Buddha Dharma, and it's difficult to understand. And partly because it's difficult, and partly because we're so embedded in our everyday, every moment experience of perception and the world and self that it's hard to align it, it's hard to hold. How can everything be nothing more than appearance when there's such solidity? Because appearance, something being just appearance, suggests that there is no solidity to that wall, that you could just walk through it. But if you try, it will stop you. Right? So it will convey to you some sense of solidity. And Buddhism doesn't deny that, right? Of course. This ground is holding us. This building is holding us. It's supporting us. So what does that mean that it's not solid, that it's an appearance, that it's illusory in nature? He says, likewise, oneself and others, the cycle of existence and liberation, in short, every entity, everything that we can experience exists merely by the power of mind and convention. And this is the heart of it. They exist merely by the power of mind and convention. I speak and you listen. This is mind. I feel light, I feel heavy. I feel rested, I feel tired. This is mind. I look out and I see people. Some are tall, some are short. Some are light-skinned and dark-skinned. Some appear as male and female. This is mind and convention. What meaning do I assign to what I see? What does it mean in my mind when I see short or tall, when I see light-skinned or dark-skinned? when I see young or old. Because I don't just see a form, I see content. I see history. I see significance. I see high and low. I see inferior and superior, worthy and unworthy. I impute all kinds of meaning into that. They exist merely by the power of mind and convention. Without mind, there is no experience. Without convention, there is no meaning. What is the reality itself? Within this statement, they exist merely by the power of mind and convention, is every heaven and every hell. Is all of existence, is all of history, is every act of generosity and every act of destruction, is every movement towards equality and every thwarting of that effort. Not just the whole of Buddhism, but the whole of our lives. Remember, Buddhism is really just reporting. It's like a reporter. Buddhism is not ultimately about Buddhism. It's not about maintaining and protecting itself. Buddhism doesn't have one, right? Buddhism is a result of the power of mind and convention. And so the Buddha, realizing mind, no history, no convention, no association, no meaning, He was faced with a dilemma of teaching, how to teach this. And how to teach this specifically, as he said, when we are so, he looked at, sort of canvassed the landscape and realized people are so wedded, he said, to their desires, but you could also say to their conventions, to our ways of seeing everything. How to free us, how to detach us, how to disenchant us from that. Because isn't that the basis of everything? What does it mean? And so think about Zazen, that in Zazen you're presented with coming to realize the question of life and death, wanting to study the fundamentals of human life and existence, eager to take that on, to enter into the way, to realize great enlightenment. You're presented with the breath. And the great challenge is, don't give it meaning. It doesn't mean anything. It's not high or low. It's not young or old. It's not enlightened or deluded. It's just breath. Can you allow that? Will you allow it to be that? Dalai Lama says, while actually existing by the power of mind convention, their mode of appearance is otherwise. So while what actually is happening is things appear to us as appearances, that is their mode of arrival, and that is through the power of mind and convention, mind and conditioning, mind and socialization, mind and messaging, mind and narrative. While that's how they appear to us, their mode of appearance, in other words, how we see them, is not like that. Due, he says, to our habituation to delusion, since time without beginning, whatever good or bad things that appear to our six types of consciousnesses do not at all seem to exist by the power of subjective convention. Nothing seems to exist by the power of my perspective, my subjective convention, my designation. They just exist. So when I look out and I see the earth and experience it as like a huge Walmart, right? Where it's just filled with stuff that I can get, right? And I try and get all that stuff for as cheap as I can, right? And then when I'm done getting that stuff, then I turn and I see the world as a big garbage heap, garbage dump. So then I just toss away what I don't want, right? So by the power of my designation, the earth becomes resources and garbage bin. And I don't see that as the power of my designation. I see that as the earth. I don't see my mind creating this reality. I don't see it appearing to me in this way as the result of mind consciousness. I see it as just what is. Its mode of appearance is otherwise. It doesn't seem at all to exist by the power of subjective convention. Everything appears to exist from the side of its basis of imputation. It is. You are. So when I look at you and I feel affinity, even though I don't know you, because you're a member of my group, or I look at you and I don't feel affinity because you're not a member of my group, I don't see that as having anything to do with my mind. It's in you. I'm just responding to you. I don't see that. What I see is that it seems to exist on the basis of imputation from its side. And so Buddhism talks about that objects have their own being, their own power. The power is in the object. And so when somebody acts in a certain way, we say, that person is good. Just look at our language. That person is bad. Their existence is this. Their existence is that. Rather than this behavior. Right? And so this is what, you know, the precepts teach. The precepts point our attention to our actions, our words, our thoughts, the consequences of those actions, the karma that we create, and how that is or is not in alignment with the path of liberation. It's not pointing to, or the consequence of, or the assessment of that is not whether you are or are not a good person. That's not in question. Good and bad are those designations that we ascribe to things that help us to navigate a world in which we have this power to create good and evil. But as practitioners, to understand that that is a convention, a necessary convention, that we apply to things to help us navigate, but that fundamentally, it's a convention. It doesn't mean it's not necessary or useful, but it is a convention. It doesn't have its own absolute truth. Why is that important? He says, that mode of existence that accords with such a deceptive manner of appearance is the subtle object of refutation. I love how he says that. That's enlightenment. That's what's being seen through. So when we chant the Heart Sutra, no eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, it's not old age and death. It's not in an end to old age and death. It's not in suffering. The cause is suffering. Cessation in the path, the subtle object of refutation, that in good and evil, it's not in good, it's not in evil. In good, there's nothing that you can find that is good. In evil, there's nothing in that that is evil in the sense that it exists on its own. It exists as evil only because of our subjective convention. And that's important. It's valuable, it's necessary. But when we become confused and I create an identity, it is good, then you become good or you become evil. A group becomes a characteristic or an assembly of characteristics. And for what purpose? Why do we do this? Why do we assign designation? Well, partly it's to navigate our world. It's to be able to do what our consciousness allows us to do, to write symphonies and operas, right? To think about things and reflect, to resolve things that need to be resolved, to write poetry, to express I love you. But how does it use us? How do those subjective conventions use us? And then how do we use them against other people? People we love, people we hate. And for what purpose? What we see in Buddhism is that everything is based in desire. Every human convention, every designation, every action is based in a desire. And that desire is based in a way of seeing ourselves in the world. Enlightenment is seeing that clearly. Delusion is not seeing that clearly. The Dalai Lama says, whatever is good or bad things appear to us, seem to exist from the side of those objects. But then he asks, how do they exist? And this is so important, because the challenge or the false idea could be that nothing exists, therefore nothing matters. Delusion doesn't matter, suffering doesn't matter, racism doesn't matter, destroying the earth doesn't matter, because it's all empty. That is not what Buddhism has or will ever teach. That's delusion. That's a designation. For what purpose? Because it lets me off the hook. The only reason I could gravitate towards that kind of indifference, that kind of apathy, is because the seeds of it are already there. I'm seeking a way to validate that kind of designation. How wonderful that I find it within a tradition of enlightenment. That must mean I'm enlightened. That works out well, right? But it's utterly false. And so to understand that things appearing as illusory appearances, illusory objects, doesn't mean that they don't appear. And he says, and this is very important, because they can help us or they can harm us, those appearances. And not only can they, but they do. And so practicing is examining and seeing through those designations of consciousness, both the ones that we assign to ourselves, right? But how do you separate yourself from everything or anything, right? How many of your thoughts belong solely to you? No one else thought them. How many ideas you have about yourself, how you identify yourself, are completely your own creation? Find one. How would you even know? How many ideas that we have about each other, about anything, belong solely to us? So what is this boundary, right, that we have between our consciousness and, we might think of it as the consciousness of the world, between our karma and the karma of the world that we live in, the worlds that we live in? That is just another convention, right? That we manifest with a wall, with a fence, with a law. In this is, the Dalai Lama says, we find no basis when we examine. So when we see a person and we say, this is a good person, and we examine, we can't find anything in them. We cannot find that good in the person. It's an idea. I spoke yesterday about love. No one would deny the reality of love. All of us feel it. All of us experience it. But no one can show me love. We can show the expression of our love. We can demonstrate our love. But to see the love itself, where is it? And so we speak of it, which is a convention, and how glorious that we can speak about it and experience it. But it's a convention. It's not, speaking about it is not love. And so we find no basis, the Dalai Lama says. The subtle object is refuted, is seen through. That's why we chant to attach to things is delusion. He says, thus they exist by the power of subjective convention by the power of our designation. And this is the history of humanity. The power of designation to name an object, to discriminate, to recognize it as separate, as different, and then to designate those differences, those qualities with truth, with absolute qualities. And so when for hundreds and hundreds of years black men have been designated as dangerous, sexual predators, untrustworthy, lazy, by white people, where is that danger? Where are those qualities? They're not in any person. And yet those behaviors, those possibilities exist in all of us. When for thousands of years women have been designated by men as weak, inferior, unstable, less intelligent, inferior, that's convention. Arising from mind, it's not in the person, it's not in the woman, it's not in any woman. Those characteristics can exist in all of us. But when they become designated, they become a convention ascribed to a whole group of people, that's mass suffering. Based in what? A desire. A desire for what? For power. To control. To gain. Right? Of course, the people who designate are always the people who are seeking the power. So when all of those parts fall away, when you look closely and cannot find those qualities in the self or the self in those qualities, looking further and cannot find man within a male form or woman within a female form, cannot find race in a dark skin or a light skin, then what happens to those designations? They are realized as appearances, as false, illusory, suffering appearances. And so to look deeply to the point where, as he says in the poem, when the vividly working wheel turns, even an expert is lost. And so the Dalai Lama says, he said, in this way, we should alternate between engaging in this kind of deep, penetrating, direct study and inspecting the manner in which events appear. And I think what he's saying here is that we need to examine this dharma, this life, this study of the self, suffering and liberation, from these two aspects. One is we have to look directly. When the front and rear parts are taken away, you take away the axle, then what will it be? In looking at the cart, there's nothing in it that where you can find cart. In looking at this physical body, arms, legs, torso, head, neck, thoughts, emotions, history, beliefs, there's nowhere in this that you can find Shugen. And yet, by convention, we give this a name. And that name, this is why in the teaching of dependent origination, name and form is such a critical moment in the pathway from delusion to suffering. Because until we name things and then begin to ascribe qualities, characteristics, and infuse them with autonomy, self-existence, own power, if that doesn't happen, then all the rest of that cycle can't occur. And so think about Zazen. When something arises, you don't name it. You don't identify it. You don't turn towards in everything you know about it. You already know all of that stuff. That's the confinement. We just practice seeing it directly. It's just sensation. You may experience it as elation or anger, sadness, boredom. That's a name. That's not the sensation. And so in Zazen, directly, what's happening is going directly. Seeing, but not strengthening that designation, those powers of convention, human convention. And it's simultaneously being illuminating those conventions and seeing how confining they are, seeing how much suffering they create. And then as we extend that off the cushion, we see how those are happening everywhere and that we've all been raised within those conventions. And some of them are helpful and some of them are not. And some of them we see and some of them we don't. But that they still have power, whether just like delusion has power. Delusion doesn't gain power the moment that we hear the word delusion. And so we're going into it directly to get to that place where all the parts have fallen away. Now what is it? And whether that's the self, whether it's an idea, race, gender, whether it's an object, and at the same time, we're illuminating our conscious mind, our convention-making mind, and developing the capacity to free ourselves of that so that we can move in the midst of and intermingle in this world of things and names and qualities, but not be fooled and not fool ourselves. So he says, in this way, we should alternate between engaging in these two examinations. Really, it's the two truths, ultimate and conventional reality, direct pointing and study of the Dharma. To go beyond all descriptions, all the false ideas, and to see even in the true, the things that we know that are true, the falseness that the falsity they become the moment that they become autonomous. That's why the Buddha said that attachment to views is one of the most destructive attachments of all. 2,500 years ago, righteousness. And what greater destructive form of righteousness is there than when it's aligned with a sense of an absolute truth? Religion, spirituality, God, enlightenment. He said it's one of the most destructive forms of attachment. And so for practitioners, it means that every step along the way, as we are realizing fundamental truths, that we are not turning them into righteousness, that we are not having realized in one moment there is nothing fixed, nothing identifiable, no identity in this, then in the next moment we create identity. Not consciously. We do it because that's what we've been trained to do. And so we have to take the next step and let go and go deeper and deeper. So in a sense we have to, as we lose all the parts, then what will it be? We have to lose our mind. Lose your mind. Lose the world. So when we sit down to do Zazen, we come into the Zendo, we do Seishin, and we leave that mind, that world, that self, we let go of it. Of course, it's not a thing. So really what that means is we're just not putting our energy, bringing forth those conventions of mind, but rather trying to lose, free ourselves, which means just not actively take up, so that we can see here and now, without that, what is it? Who are you? Who am I? What is this life? Even an expert is lost when the vividly working wheel turns in all directions, above and below, south, north, east, and west. Complete freedom that is manifesting in this world of history and convention and names and forms. And so the bodhisattva, the enlightened being, moves amidst delusion knowingly. It's like seeing the magician and seeing the show, but seeing the illusion as it's happening. It's like pulling aside the curtain on the Wizard of Oz. Who do you think is the one sitting there? So I'll end with a poem. The sacred mountain, majestic and still, because it cannot be found in grandeur or in stillness, it walks over water. This perfect human form, beautiful and strong, because it can never be known, you are free to cherish and uphold.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.